In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Please be seated. Once upon a time, there was a king of a vast empire. He was very rich, and he loved to show off his opulent wealth. He threw parties with copious food, and the drinking was done, quote, by the flagon and without restraint. He was married to a beautiful queen. She was so beautiful, he liked to show her off to his friends, so they could see how beautiful she was. One night, however, when the king was, quote, merry with wine, he called for the queen to come be paraded about, but she refused. And for this act of insubordination, or independence, depending on how you look at it, she was unceremoniously deposed and blacklisted across the entire kingdom. The king made an executive order outlining her banishment so that all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike, because every man should be the master in his own house. After a little while, the king had calmed down, and he decided to find a replacement wife to serve as his queen. There was a commission appointed to gather all the beautiful young virgins from across the entire empire and to have them brought to the harem in the city and give them a year of cosmetic treatments. When the time came for each of the women to be presented to the king, they were sent to his chambers to spend the night, and in the morning they would be sent back. If the king was pleased with his experience, he would call for that woman again. And this went on for some time. But in this bevy of beautiful maidens, there was one woman more beautiful than all the rest. And when she, the fairest of them all, went in to the king, he was so enraptured, he made her his queen. Her name, as you may have guessed, was Esther. The twist in this story is that Esther was a Jew. But no one knew this because living in the Persian Empire as a Jew was not a good thing, so she kept it a secret. The rest of the plot unfolds as follows. The king had a wicked advisor who we heard about, Haman, who used his wiles to get the king to sign an edict allowing for the annihilation of all the Jews in the empire. With some prompting from her adopted father, Mordecai, Esther decides to risk her life by revealing her ethnicity and using her position as queen to stop this edict from being carried out. So she gets all dolled up, and the king is again so enraptured by her beauty that he promises to give her whatever she wants. So she asks him to a banquet, and then another banquet the next night, prolonging the tease, to the point where the king, mad with lust and merry with wine, is ready to promise her half of his kingdom if she asks for it. And it is then, at the dramatic climax of the story, that she reveals who she is and her petition to him, "Save me and my people." And this is our Old Testament portion from this morning that we just heard. The king agrees, the Jews are saved, Haman is hanged, and Esther is a heroine. This is meant to be a triumphant story. But I have to admit, it was not a pleasant experience reading back through it this week, because while the ending is a happy one for the Jews, I couldn't help but be sickened by the way in which the plot centers on the unabashed objectification and exploitation of women in this ancient Persian court. Even though she is courageous, Esther is only granted this position of power because she is beautiful. And while she uses that power to good effect, her value and the value of all the other nameless women in this story is tied to how they look and how much pleasure they can bring to the king and the other men of the court who hold all the power. I'd like to think we've come a long way from the courts of the Persian Empire and their harems. But I'm not so sure. We're not so blatant in the parading of women in front of men for their pleasure as King Ahasuerus was, and women certainly have far more rights and freedoms and powers than they did back then, but if we have learned anything from the past year in our country, and most visibly and viscerally from this past week in our country, It is that the objectification and the violation of women is still very much with us, and tragically so. From the most highly respected positions in our government, to the world of news and entertainment, to business and sports, and even, yes, even in the church, men and women, but mostly women, have been stepping forward to say, "Me too. I, too, have been treated like this." Across the world, women and their allies have taken to the streets by the millions to say, "Enough." The prevalence of these confessions may have come as a surprise to some of us because we like to think we are living in a much more egalitarian society than we are. But as this Me Too era has rolled out and more women have been emboldened to come forward with their stories of harassment and abuse, it has drawn back the curtain on the reality of belittlement and danger that the women in our lives have to navigate every day. If you're like me, the most gut-wrenching aspect of this movement has been hearing women you know and love, perhaps your wives or your sisters, your mothers, your daughters, tell stories of violation heretofore kept secret. When I was in high school, I was a member of a program that tried to eradicate sexual and domestic violence through education, and I learned there that 1 in 4 women are sexually assaulted in their lifetime. Harassment numbers are even higher and harder to track, and these numbers are probably woefully low because these crimes are notoriously underreported. These statistics have stayed pretty much the same, and in some cases gotten worse in the 20 or so years since I first learned them, and given those numbers, I imagine that some of you or someone you love has lived through that awful experience. And I imagine that that made this an especially hard week for you. And I'm sorry. The way in which this high school group went about doing its work was by going into middle schools and teaching those kids about the kind of language they used, the jokes they told, and the ways that they could, as bystanders, stop these kinds of things from happening. We introduced to them some of the toxic forms of masculinity that they would encounter. Be tough, be in control, take what's yours. And the toxic forms of femininity that the girls would encounter. Don't speak up, be pleasant and pleasing to everybody. So that they could at least at that age get some level of initial awareness. Because such words and ideas are the poisonous seeds that produce the rotten fruit that we've been hearing about these past months. A society that allows the objectification of women through jokes or belittling comments, and a culture that highlights their physical attributes above all else, a world that inculcates in our boys that they deserve to be, quote, masters of their own house, as King Ahasuerus decreed, is a society that is structuring itself on a profound imbalance of power. And one of the most important things you learn in this kind of work is that sexual assault or harassment or rape are rarely about sex. They're about power. And having such a dramatic power imbalance ingrained in our society makes things ripe for exploitation. Jesus has a lot to say about power. And for just this reason, I think. Some of his strongest language and actions were reserved for those people who had power and used it exploitatively. To the Pharisees, who used their sacred authority as means to get seats of honor or offerings while neglecting matters of justice and fairness, it was, "Woe be unto you." The same for the lawyers who used their expertise to load people up with burdens and did nothing to ease them. And for those money changers in the temple who sought to squeeze an extra few coins out of poor people on their way into worship, he flipped their tables and sent them scurrying away. And then, of course, there is our gospel passage for today, which includes some of Jesus' strongest and most shocking language of all. He picks up on the discourse he began last week about letting the little children come to me. And he says, if any of you adults put a stumbling block before one of these little ones, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. And he goes on to triple down on that same point with his examples about how if your hand or your foot or your eye causes you to stumble, cut it off or you'll end up in hell. Strong words from the Prince of Peace. But as Father Tim mentioned last week, to be a child in ancient Palestine was a precarious and powerless position to be in. The extremity, the strength of Jesus' language in this passage is reserved for those adults who would use their power to trip up or exploit these little ones. Over and over again, those who take their power and misuse and abuse it to violate or inhibit others are condemned in no uncertain terms. But if the abuse of power is clearly condemned by Jesus' teaching, the proper use of it is what is on display by the life that he lived and the death that he died. The message he embodied as he walked this earth was that true power, real power, comes from an embrace of powerlessness, both in the sense of embracing and empowering those who the world has rendered powerless, and in giving up our own power to do so. That's what God did in becoming flesh and walking among us, gave up his power so he could show us what real power looked like. O God, you declare your almighty power chiefly in showing mercy and pity. Our collect begins this morning. Not control or force, but mercy and pity. That's where God's almighty power is shown most truthfully. If, as a society, we're going to make any progress on the issue of sexual assault and harassment, we're going to need to make progress on how we deal with power. Specifically, how we share it and how we give it up. As parents, as citizens, as individuals, we need to commit to being a part of the solution to this problem through the way we treat women, through the way we teach people to treat women, and through the people that we put in power to make and enforce laws about how women can be treated. We're going to need to be more than just passive bystanders who shake our heads at this misbehavior of, oh, those creeps. And for this to happen, men in particular, upon whom society still bestows an inordinate amount of power, are going to have to become better acquainted with powerlessness. A willful giving up of control, because it will mean giving up our seat of privilege at the proverbial table so that other voices, in this case women's voices, can be heard more regularly and more clearly. And where better to practice powerlessness, the willful giving up of control? Where better to confess the sins of ourselves and our society than here at the altar of the one whose power is exhibited most fully in dying on the cross? The one who suffered acts of violence rather than commit a single one. The one whose most fervent prayer was, "Not my will, but yours be done." The salvation of our society can be found in Jesus Christ, who would not stand for a moment for any misuse or abuse of power, and who incarnated a way to a real, lasting strength that was generous, merciful, and yet still indestructible. The events and revelations of this past year have been painful, but necessary. They have shown us that the problem of sexual assault and harassment crosses all races and classes and parties and creeds, and I hope by this point we can all recognize that the status quo is unacceptable. We need to do better. We need to be better. It starts now, and it starts right here.